Did I ever tell you about the time my brother tried to get a fox in the car?
No.
I was coming back from Southern California, and I used to take the Amtrak. And so if any of you have ever done the Amtrak from Southern California to Northern California, you have to take a train,
But
depending on where you're coming from in Southern California. So I had to take a train from Orange County to LA, and then a bus from LA to Bakersfield, and then you take a train from Bakersfield to Fresno. And so I always hated having to be on the train because it makes a lot of stops, so it takes a lot longer than if you were just to drive from Bakersfield to Fresno. So my dad and my brother actually drove to Bakersfield and hung out with my dad's best friend who lives in Bakersfield, and then they chilled there and waited for me at the train station. It's super late at this point. Like, I think I rolled in at like 9 p.m. in fucking Bakersfield. So while they were waiting for me, my dad was in the car with my brother, and he saw a fox in the parking lot. And then where their Amtrak station is in Bakersfield, it's like this industrial downtowny type area. Like, there's nothing there. There's no, not really any lights, nothing. They're pretty much alone in this parking lot. And this, he sees a fox. So my brother goes, "Look, it's a fox." And my dad's like, "Okay, cool." And my brother opens the door to the car, and he goes, and like, it's trying to
Like, what the fuck is he gonna do with it?
like
Josh, what are
a
you
cat.
doing?
I know. So my dad goes, "The hell are you doing, son? Close the door." I'm just like, I was just trying to get it to come over. What
Dog.
the
It's not like a domesticated dog that you're like,
It's
"Here,
not at
puppy."
all. It's a wild fucking
Oh,
animal
fucking
that can
Josh.
claw and bite the shit out of you. And my brother was straight up, without hesitation, trying to bring it into the car. And my dad was like,
Easy.
"What the fuck are you doing?" And so obviously the fox did not come. And my
Yeah, because
brother
he's
had to
not
close
gonna
the
respond
door.
to, "Come here." What is
Yeah,
that what
he's
the
a
fox
fucking
says? Get out of
dog.
here.
So this happened like right before my bus came. And so I got in the car, and they were super quick to tell me the story. And I thought it was the funniest fucking thing, because only if you know my brother, like, this is 100% on brand for my brother to try to get a fox into like my parents' car. What was he gonna do with it if it actually got in the car? I don't know, but we might have ended up taking a fox home. Like,
Just be like, "It's a new pet. He'll love
so
him."
I don't know. So that was my brother. So in summary, do not try to bring wild animals
No.
into your vehicle. Welcome, everybody, to State of Murder. I'm your host, Selena Cooper.
And I'm your other host, Amber Ratzlaff. And this week we are in the great state of Louisiana.
Yeah, our first official southern state
We
where they
are.
have Mardi Gras and all kinds of fun things. Spoiler alert, Louisiana is not a state I've been to, but it is a state I'd love to go to, mainly because I'd like to go to New Orleans. I think that
Oh,
would be really cool. My dad's been and he.
yeah. I also have not been to Louisiana, and I would also like to go because of New Orleans. So, you
Nice.
know.
Yeah, my dad went before Katrina, like a few years before Katrina, and he loved it because if you're a fan of jazz music, if you're a fan of good food, he says that is the place to go. Like, you're gonna get some good food and some good music down there. So it made me pretty excited to go. I would like to go one day, hopefully, preferably not during hurricane season, because people who live in states that get
Oh,
hit by
heck no.
hurricanes,
Hell
y'all are
no.
crazy.
Yeah, no,
I
thank you.
cannot.
Disasters.
We always end up talking about natural disasters,
And basing off where we are willing to live based off of what natural disasters occur there. And we're like, and no, hurricanes, I'm finally in agreement with you. Hurricane, although I live in Earthquakeville, but you know, whatever. But hurricanes, heck no. That is my, no, there's no way. So
Yep.
yeah, yeah, your
Yeah,
earthquakes
I will
any
take
day.
earthquakes all day, every day
Over
over
a hurricane.
rushing waves of water and things. That's like you're mixing a tornado with water. That is awful. Like, if tornadoes, like, why would tornadoes need to be worse? Like, what's the point? Yeah,
Exactly.
no.
No, I am
Not
with
getting me
you.
today.
So, not during hurricane season, not really during the summer, because I freaking hate humidity with a passion. And I know Louisiana, I'm sure, is freaking humid as all get out. And I don't like that. So I'm okay with our dry heat. So
isn't summer and hurricane season kind of the same time though?
It is, but
I think cold front and the heat front.
Yeah. But I just imagine Louisiana.
Because I want to say Katrina was in August.
Well, and I think humidity is around for a lot of time in Louisiana because I don't think it gets really cold. I could be wrong. I haven't been there, so I don't know. But yeah, I just, no humidity. Yeah,
I doubt it gets cold because you look at like Southern California is kind of on par with that, just on the other side. And Southern California hardly gets cold.
Yeah. But we both want to go there. So hopefully we travel there sometime soon once the world stops being crazy.
Yes. So that's a goal. Maybe we'll plan a vacation. We'll go to New Orleans. That'd be dope.
Our friend,
we're coming for you, Louisiana.
I know. Our friend Jose and I have always talked about going to New Orleans. We were going to go a couple years ago during Christmas, but the plane tickets were like $800. And I was like, and never mind.
I know. You can only imagine how expensive they'd probably be near Mardi Gras.
Yeah. So we did not go, but we will go.
That's nice. All right. So what story do you have for us this week?
All right. So this week, I'm going to be taking you guys on a journey down to Cato Parish, Louisiana. Specifically, we're going to be talking about Shreveport. So I'm going to be telling you guys about the murder of Jarvis Griffin. Now, I always try to focus on murder victims when I'm trying to tell you guys about a case, but I know I'm not always successful in this because Selena can attest to this too, is when you're kind of looking up information on true crime or murder stories, a lot of time the focus is on from the media or books written or even what journalists tell is always focused on the criminal or the murderer. So this week, sadly, there isn't a lot of information on Jarvis, as this murder has turned into another crime altogether. So just keep that in mind. I did try to find a lot of some more information on Jarvis, but just nothing was available. Okay. Jarvis Griffin was 26 years old on January 4th, 1998. He worked as a pizza delivery man and he was doing his job in that evening. He didn't know what was planned for him or that his final delivery was going to be happening. So after he went up to this house, knocked on the door, delivered his pizza, he went back to his car and got in. He was then shot multiple times. His body was found slumped over the steering wheel, having been shot in the chest and the neck. He had been robbed of all of his money and the rest of the pizzas that he was scheduled to deliver. When police arrived on the scene, there were witnesses that pointed them in the direction to kind of where they should start their investigation. The witnesses stated that several men had been involved in the shooting and robbery of Jarvis. So they were identified as 16-year-old Gabriel Logan, his older brother Nathan, and Chris Moore, whose nickname was Rapist. So
what an awful nickname to have. Also, how old were the brother and his friend?
So I believe that Nathan was 20, and I never saw how old Moore was, but I think he was the oldest, so I'm guessing in his early 20s.
Okay, because I'm like, 16 is super young to be doing something like that.
Yeah, so just, and the nickname, I couldn't find any written documentation on why his nickname was that. It just, like, every article made sure to note that that was his nickname. It's like, dang. Like, I've heard some nicknames, but that one is really bad. That's worse than our last week's episode when the guy's nickname was Possum.
I know. Or didn't you tell a story one time where someone's nickname was Blackie?
Yeah.
Like, one of the, I think it was in, what, Kansas's episode?
Yeah, Kansas.
I mean,
I don't think nicknames. That he picked that. I don't know if this guy picked that nickname. If he did, ay caramba.
I know. Yeah, so, way to be kind of on the nose, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if he was a rapist, like, I don't know. Like, maybe.
Oh, so we don't even know if it was in his past or not. That was just
There's nothing. So if somebody was just like, you rapist, I don't know. It's weird. So
okay.
So the police brought all three boys in for interrogation. During their interviews, all of them named a different guy as the shooter, and this guy was Corey Williams. They even directed the police to where they could find the gun that had been used to shoot Jarvis. Then they also stated that they had divvied up the money amongst themselves, so that's where the money went. With the guy so quickly turning on Williams, the cops went to go bring him in. When they arrived at Williams' grandmother's house, they found him huddled underneath a sheet on the couch, and they were quick to notice that he had peed his pants in fear. Interesting note. The police brought Williams down to the police station and started asking him a whole bunch of questions. In his very first interview, Williams stated that he had been there and he had witnessed Gabriel Logan shooting Jarvis. He then stated that Gabriel had just called him and told him that he would kill him if he didn't take the fall for the murder. So I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about Corey Williams. Corey was also 16, just like Gabriel Logan. He had been hanging out in the Logan's house that day, so he was with them. He was 16 at the time of Jarvis's murder. His attorneys reported that Corey had suffered from a severe case of lead poisoning when he was younger, so I think this is what led him to have intellectual disabilities. He was documented to have an IQ of 68. He was known to suck his thumb, wet his pants, and he had a severe case of pica. So he liked to eat like dirt and paper and all sorts of things. So he was kind of known about town for those things. His family stated that everybody kind of referred to him as a chump and kind of was quick to know that he would take the fall for anybody and that he would admit to stuff even if he didn't do it. Aww. So just after 12 hours of being interrogated by the police, so they picked him up the night of January 4th. And interrogated him all night till about 9 o'clock in the morning the next day. So with no sleep, Corey ended up confessing to having been the one that shot and killed Jarvis. After he made his confession, all Corey said was that he was ready to go home and lay down. With his confession, the cops stopped all investigation and had Corey charged with first degree murder. So pretty open and shut case, with the others pointing the finger at Corey and himself confessing to the crime. Well, at least that is what the prosecutors wanted you to focus on. Soon after his confession, though, Corey recanted and stated that he was innocent. Now, I'm going to list to you guys the other things that they did find in the investigation. So, or at least what was disclosed in the investigation. So there was the gun that was found that the police had, or the boys had led the police to. However, when it was fingerprinted, the only fingerprints found on the gun were Nathan Logan's. The only blood other than in the car that was found on Gabriel Logan's t-shirt. And the stolen pizzas and money were actually located near Logan's house in a dumpster. However, none of this really seemed to matter to the prosecutors. They wanted Corey to get the death penalty. Chris Moore, you remember, nicknamed rapist, even was their key witness and testified against Corey. So Corey ended up being found guilty of Jarvis's murder and sentenced to death. Gabriel Logan was convicted of second-degree murder and given life with hard labor and no possibility of parole. Now, normally, this is where our story would end, right? Case wrapped up. Everybody was convicted. However, Jarvis, it turns out, wasn't the only victim here. As I'm sure you guys are all yelling at me, and you're wondering, okay, what happened to the other two guys? So the two other guys, nothing happened to them. So when I started reading this, I was like, these convictions just don't sound right. Everything's not adding up to me. So especially because there was no physical evidence to link Corey to this crime at all. What about the other witnesses? So there, remember I told you right at the beginning that witnesses had pointed to the three guys. So what about those? Mm-hmm. Like, what was going on? Well, to better answer my questions, and probably yours, we have to look into some local history of Cato Parish. So okay. Cato Parish made a name for itself when it came to handing out death sentences. They actually have the highest rate of death sentences in the country per capita. So they're quite heavy handed with putting people on death row. One of the reasons for this was prosecutor Hugo Holland. So he was actually the prosecutor on Corey's case. Holland had tried dozens of death penalty cases prior to Corey's and had put at least 10 people on death row, mostly, of course, men of color. Now, by now, we all know.
Surprise.
I know, shocking. So by now, if you've listened to a lot of our episodes, you know that I am staunchly against the death penalty for many reasons, but this is one of the cases that fits in with my reasons why. So Holland has actually had over half of his death penalty convictions overturned. Why, you may ask? Well, many of Holland's practices have started to come into question. So Cato Parish by 2018 had people increasingly stating that there was a lot of misconduct by prosecutors. So you had Glenn Ford, who had been wrongfully convicted of murder in 1984. He ended up being exonerated and released in 2014. Rodicus Crawford, who was also prosecuted by Holland, was also exonerated for the murder of his baby son. So he ended up not having killed him. I read his case, actually. He was one that I was thinking about doing. And his case, Holland decided to go against medical testimony, which stated that the boy, that his son had actually died, I believe, of sepsis and pneumonia, which I don't know how that equals murder. I didn't read the whole case, but he was convicted and put on death row for it. And so his case actually was overturned. God. Yeah. So I can't even imagine that poor man. So Holland has been accused of withholding evidence in at least three cases. Corey's case was one of those cases. So one of the articles I read that was written in 2018 reported that Holland actually was fired from being he was assistant district attorney in 2012 after it was found that he had doctored documents so that he could get his hands on like this load of M16 rifles from the federal government's military surplus. So I didn't even know that like random, like just everyday people could buy military surplus, but apparently, and especially like M16s, but apparently they can. It was I don't know what laws and regulations. I'm sure they have some because he doctored some documents. It was reported that he wanted these guns. You're gonna like this, Selena. because I'm sorry, this is so silly. He wanted these guns as he was forming a paramilitary style group for the zombie response team. Now, I don't know if you believe it. I didn't really look up what the zombie response team was, but if it's actually in case of a zombie apocalypse, like, and he's their like one of their leading district attorneys. What?
Oh my God. Okay, first off, I think it's like Amber's correct. I mean, I think it's interesting. I like horror movies, and zombies are kind of my favorite like type of antagonist, but you don't need a zombie response team. Like, what is his possible reasoning for that? I mean,
I don't know.
Like, I think it's funny when people like paint their Jeeps and stuff and say like zombie protection unit, blah, blah, blah. And it's like a joke, like, we're just making it look like not legitimately buying military weapons to fight off something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And when he was talking about criminals and the death penalty, he once stated that the only thing we can do with the animals that do stuff like this is put them down.
Wow.
So he seems like a real, real great district attorney.
Yeah, awesome. Definitely who I'd want helping
prosecuting our cases here. Okay, so getting back to Corey's case, after his conviction, his attorneys started their appeal process. First, though, in 2002, the United States Supreme Court ended up barring the death penalty for people with intellectual disabilities, in part because they are at a heightened risk of unwittingly confessing to a crime that they did not commit. Mm-hmm. And then the Supreme Court also ruled that those under the age of 18 at the time of the crime cannot get the death penalty. So Corey's case was looked at, and his sentence was changed to life in prison without parole, as he fit both of those statutes. His attorney still thought that Corey's rights had been violated, however. For 20 years, they worked to get him freed. In 2015, Corey's attorneys found evidence that had not been disclosed to the defense during his trial. So Holland, prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Selena, if you've watched Making a Murderer, like especially the second season. But
I didn't get to watch the second season, but the brother was immediately who I thought of.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Dassey. Brandon. Mm-hmm. Or Brendan. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Yeah. So, yeah, you can definitely think that definitely goes hand in hand. But if you watch that, or even if you listen to a lot of true crime stories, so like Adnan Syed, there's a number. You'll always come across an attorney named Kathleen Zellner. So, especially in the second season of Making a Murderer. So if you've ever heard of her, you have definitely heard of Brady violations. So Brady violations. These violations came from a court case in 1963, Brady versus Maryland, which states that prosecutors must provide evidence to the defense if it is deemed useful to the defense. So basically, prosecutors end up working with the police during the investigation and have access to everything. So they're really, in fact, the gatekeepers of all the information that the defense gets for their clients, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem with this is that they're tasked to decide what's relevant to the case and irrelevant to the case. So if they deem it irrelevant to the case, they don't necessarily have to give it to the defense. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this is what happened in Corey's case. Holland got to choose what he provided to the defense. And in Louisiana, prosecutors are allowed to provide summaries of witness statements and not the whole thing.
So they can leave out whatever they want if they don't think it's relevant.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Louisiana.
So I'm guessing this might be in other cities or states too, but since I was reviewing this case and this is where I got the information, it just specifically talks about Louisiana. So even though his attorneys repeatedly requested them, they didn't receive any of the witness statements as a whole. They received these summaries. When they finally got the evidence that wasn't provided during his trial in 2000, this is what was left out. So they realized that some of the summaries had kind of been altered to fit the prosecution's narrative. Mm-hmm. So the police did not think that Corey committed this crime. So mm-hmm. even though the boys pointed the finger at Corey, they all were like, no, you guys are just laying the blame on somebody. You guys obviously did this. It wasn't Corey. So they didn't really believe any of that. One witness even had stated that they had seen Moore, aka rapist, that he was guilty because they had just seen him with the gun prior to the murder. So the gun was in Moore's hand. One of the brothers, so it didn't say which one, because I didn't get a look at the actual tapes or anything, stated that it made no sense for Corey to have committed the crimes, so this murder, and that it had actually been his brother and Moore. So that was his statement. That, of course, didn't show up in the evidence that the attorneys got. So yeah. When this was brought to the Louisiana court's attention, they found that the evidence presented would not have changed the outcome of the guilty verdict. So they didn't even decide to hear the case. So the Louisiana Supreme Court, the So the residing district attorney in 2015, he's a peach of a man. If you like Collins, you'll like Cox. So it was Dale Cox, stated that the state presented the jury a confession that was wholly corroborated by eyewitness testimony, which we now know that probably wasn't true. Cox firmly believes, so this is some of the things Cox, so we talked about Holland and his, like, killing the animals. So mm-hmm. Cox firmly believed that the state needs to actually kill more people than they are, and he's a lot of the reason why they're the number one to get people on death row from 2010 to 2014. He was pretty instrumental mm-hmm. in becoming that awesome statistic. So his beliefs about the death penalty are as follows. Over time, I have come to the position that revenge is important for society as a whole. We have certain rules that you are expected to abide by, and when you don't abide by them, you forfeit your right to live among us. So he doesn't believe that the death penalty actually deters criminals, and that it should be wholly used just as societal revenge on people.
Wow.
So,
God damn it, Louisiana.
I know. So, yeah, he's a real great guy. In March of 2018, Corey's attorneys filed for a petition with the Supreme Court of the United States. So really, it was the last chance for Corey. And when they filed this petition, a group of 44 former prosecutors, Justice Department officials, including the former U.S. Attorney General Michael, I'm going to pronounce her last name wrong, Mukasey, signed a brief in support of the petition stating that Corey's case should be overturned and he should be retried because they didn't think he did it. So that's like 44 prosecutors from around the country stating that something shady had happened in Louisiana and it wasn't right and that Brady violations had happened. By this time, Holland and Cox, so those wonderful district attorneys, were no longer working for Cato Parish. So the people of Cato County, I know, ended up not reelecting Cox in 2016. And as you remember, Holland had been fired because he wanted to outfit his zombie people. The next district attorney, James Stewart, agreed right after the filing in 2018 to immediately release Corey if he agreed to plead guilty to manslaughter, so a lesser sentence.
But he didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So that's bullshit.
Yeah. So as I would have probably said, and maybe many of you who are listening, I would have said, fuck that deal. I didn't do it. No. Obviously, Cato County knows that they were wrong and that something was happening because they fought so hard for 20 years to be like, no, 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 he deserves to be in prison. And all of a sudden, James Stewart's like, no, there might have been something, some legal things that didn't go right. So this was kind of his way. It apparently is common practice for prosecutors to offer this when defendants have credible claims of innocence. So to take that lesser sentence. So it happened in 2016 in Cato Parish with Curtis Davis, who had been wrongfully convicted of a second degree murder. He also accepted a plea deal of manslaughter. These deals are made pretty much for the state to save face as well as the prosecutors, because nobody has to take responsibility for their actions in the crime. But the victim, I'm calling them victims because they all are. And the victim is released. So with these agreements, sadly, they agree that they give up all of their rights to bring civil suits against anybody from Louisiana government, law enforcement. So Corey took this deal. Corey's lawyer stated that due to Corey's disabilities, he suffered a lot in the 20 years he spent in prison. He was very abused by other inmates. Apparently, Angola Prison is known for being very, very tough. So I know it's sad. So on May 22nd, 2018, Corey ended up walking out of Angola Prison a free man. However, he was still convicted of murder, even if it was just manslaughter. He ended up having to grow up and spend over half his life in prison being tormented. His attorney stated that Corey is just the loveliest, warmest human being you would ever know. And he was just over the moon to be able to go home after 20 years wrongfully behind bars. Aww. So he just took it. And the reason they took it is because even though it was possible that the U.S. Supreme Court would hear his case, it hadn't been granted yet. And even if it is, he could have spent years more in prison waiting for them to make the decision. And then he could also be retried for the case. And who knows where they would have, what would have been decided if he would have gotten an innocent plea or not.
Also, that's such a bullshit thing, because one, they're trying to save face, but two, even though he's out of prison, he still loses those rights that he can't vote, he can't, like, it's gonna hurt him in terms of finding a job or a house or qualifying for things. Like, it's such fucking bullshit, because you still are ruining this man's life.
Exactly.
You fucked up.
Yeah, because of a fuck up for letting prosecutors be dishonest and just let them, you know, have information that they deem appropriate. I think that's crap. Anything that the prosecution sees, I think defense should see. Everybody should be on an equal playing field. So Hugo Holland, apparently, is still practicing law in Louisiana as a freelance prosecutor. He keeps on trying capital murder cases. So he just kind of floats between parishes, trying these cases, so he still represents and is a prosecutor. Holland is also currently working with the Louisiana District Attorneys Association to lobby legislators against much needed criminal justice reform.
Of course he is.
Yep. So when Holland was asked for a comment after Corey was released, he stated that he didn't conceal anything. That was total horseshit. Didn't know he was out, and Corey shouldn't be out because he's a murderer. Corey's case with the others I mentioned have become a symbol, though, for prosecutorial abuse and the broken judicial system in Louisiana. So although Louisiana isn't alone in this, many places across the United States have shown that they have wrongly wrongfully convicted people all the time, which is one of, I mean, not the only reason, but one of the main, a lot of the reason why I'm against the death penalty, because if you can't be right 100% of the time and know for sure 100% of the time that that person is guilty, then you can't put people to death. And yeah. we see time and time again that these people, like, especially now with more at like capability of DNA evidence and just like, we see all of these people that are interrogated for hours upon hours and they finally, mm-hmm. you know, confess to a crime that they didn't do so yeah. that they can just go home. And so you brought up Brandon Dassey from Making a Murderer. He's well known that he was told that he could go home. You saw a video of it. You see his interview mm-hmm. and his interrogation. And he also had some developmental delays and disabilities. So it really puts into question what kind of confession that is. And so that's the exact same thing with Corey. Like, did he know what he was confessing to? Did he understand he had a right to a lawyer because there wasn't one in the room? You know, and it's just that they don't understand their rights. And so to be able to hold that up in a court of law and say, here's this confession, it doesn't have any specifics. It's just that pretty much, yeah, me and my friends were hanging out and I shot him. And yeah. there it goes. Open, shut case. So at least... Mm-hmm. I mean, at least Corey's out of prison now. That was in 2018. I didn't find any other information about what he's doing right now, but I'm sure his life isn't all sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows, because he still has that conviction of manslaughter on his record.
And not only that, like, it sounds like he went through a lot while he was in prison, so that, I mean, PTSD could be a real thing in that situation. We don't know what mm-hmm. kind of trauma he went through. Poor guy.
And there's the other two guys. Like,
yeah, what the hell happened to them?
So, well, yes, Gabriel is in prison for life, doing whatever the frick life without parole and hard labor means in Louisiana. It doesn't sound great. But there are two other guys, one more, who testified in court that it was Corey. And we all pretty much doubt that Corey had anything to do with the actual shooting, you mm-hmm. know. So, like, did he lie in court? So he was identified with the gun. I don't know. Like, there's just a lot of questions. And those two never really, they weren't tried for anything. So.
God damn it, Louisiana.
So that's my story. And I mean, Jarvis, he doesn't get a lot of it, even though he was the murderer. Or murderer. He was the murderer. He was the victim. He was murdered. Victim. But, you know, there was more victims than just him in that case. And it sounds like, I mean, half of Holland's death penalty cases were overturned for one reason or another. So it sounds like a lot of victims were in Louisiana and Cato Parish in the 2000s.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what's your story going to be today?
So my story this week is about Zach Bowen and Addie Hall. I'll give you another one, but just for right now, before we get into the story, there is a disclaimer on this one that it is very graphic once I get to what happened, because there is a lot of detail. And I kind of gloss over certain, like, overly graphic details of things because I don't think they're very relevant. In this case, I wanted to keep the graphic details in, and I'll explain at the end why I kept them in, but I do think they are relevant to this case. So despite it making my stomach turn, it is. So if you don't want to hear it, just go ahead and skip to the end. You can hear our fun fact segment and not have to listen to my story at all. But I will give another disclaimer before I start into the graphic description. So if you want to hear some of the case and then maybe just skip the graphic details and we can come back in at the end, feel free to do that as well. But I did want to give you a heads up on that. So
okay.
Also too, the reason it's about both of these two, even though one of them does perpetrate the crime, is because I do think they are both victims in some way to this, and you'll find out why. So here's my story on Zach Bowen and Addie Hall. Zach Bowen was a laid-back, charming young man who grew up in California, reports say in Los Angeles, I believe. And in the summer of 1995, Zach and his father took a trip to Louisiana. There, Zach fell in love with the city of New Orleans and decided to make it his home. Zach got a job working as a bartender, and fell in love with a woman named Lana, who was a dancer from Texas. Everyone kept saying dancer, but I did read somewhere that it was the exotic type of dancer. Okay. But I don't know. Either way, irrelevant. She was a dancer from Texas. Lana became pregnant, and not wanting to hold Zach, who was 10 years younger than the 27-year-old, to being a father so young, she tried to break off the relationship. Yes. A lot of things in that situation, because one, he did not tell her he was 17, so she didn't find out until after they had already been together and she was pregnant. And
my goodness.
Two, how is a 17-year-old working in a bar?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions there.
There is. They didn't go too much into it, and it's not super relevant, but come on, New Orleans. Like, why is he 17 and working in a bar?
Yeah, maybe he had some fake in from, like, some fake papers or something stating he was 21.
Yeah. Or maybe Louisiana just has really lax laws when it comes to that. Because I know in California.
Yeah, even to sell it, like, at a grocery store, don't you have to be 21?
Yes. Same thing too. If you work at the movie theater, so some of our movie theaters, I don't know if this is everywhere, but in California, some of our movie theaters sell alcohol now. And if you are behind the counter serving the alcohol, you have to be 21 to serve it. So you can't even be anywhere near, like, if someone orders it from you, somebody else has to take care of it because you cannot serve them alcohol. But who knows? Louisiana, maybe they're a little different.
Maybe.
So, even though Lana tried to break up the relationship, Zach instead proposed to her, and they ended up getting married. Family and friends were concerned since marriage didn't
seem to... But she knew that he was 17 by this point.
But I think he was close enough to 18. Like, I think it was like, at that point, you're committed to this relationship, and you're having a kid together.
I'm super okay with it, because he's still a kid, and even though she's the woman, I know a lot of times people are like, oh, you go boy, but if it was a girl, they'd be like, ooh, pedophile. But okay.
Yes. But because she didn't know, and honestly, like, looking at the pictures of him, he does look, like, there's no possible way she would have doubted him if he told her he was, like, you know, like, that he was 18 or 19 or whatever. And it doesn't say, I don't think their relationship was, like, super long before she became pregnant. Okay. Because remember, they met at a bar. So my guess is there was a lot of alcohol consumed in this relationship. So they got married. But the family and friends didn't really think it was something he wanted to do. A lot of my information, I had a lot of articles for my information. But there was actually a TV special from the Investigation Discovery Channel. So ID, they have a special called Handsome Devils, and they do a show. There was an episode on this. So I actually got to hear his mom, Lana, some friends and family of the two. They all talked about it. So his mom even said, like, he had plans to be an English teacher. So getting married at 17, generally not, like, on his to-do list that soon.
Okay.
But they had their first child and soon after had a second child, and the family remained pretty supportive. So they showed home videos of them with the kids. So after the arrival of their second child, Zach knew he was going to have to get a good job to support his family. He enlisted in the army in 2000 and was eventually stationed in Iraq. And while he was there, I couldn't find his exact position. So in one article I read, they said he was like a sergeant. And in the other article I read, they said he was military police in Iraq. He even spent some time in Abu Ghraib, if I'm saying that right. I don't know if I'm saying that right. But if you didn't know the reason, because I kept wondering, I had to look it up because I was like, why do they keep mentioning the fact that he spent time in Abu Ghraib? I'm so sorry if I'm not pronouncing that right. But I hate mispronouncing things. But they kept bringing it up, and I was like, why is this so important? Well, it turns out that was the place where there was a prison where the CIA and the army committed a series of human rights violations during the war. Like, there was a whole thing on it where they were torturing people, like, physically, sexually. They were murdering people there. It was a whole thing. Apparently, there was this big trial about it. It said he only spent some time there, which is why I wasn't sure if he was military police or a sergeant. I didn't know what his role was. But, I mean, still, even if you're only there and stationed there for a little bit, if all that's going on around you, that's pretty fucking traumatic.
Yeah.
So during his time in the war, a few events really stuck with him. They talked about, one was, I believe it was a fellow soldier. It was a woman that was a friend of his, and she was blown up. And it didn't really say like how or what the situation, it was just an enemy attack. And the second was when he befriended an Iraqi boy. And when it was discovered that they were friends, the enemy murdered the boy and his family. They blew up his shop.
Okay.
It didn't say how old he was, the boy. It just, they just kept mentioning him. But either way, like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
That he was just making friends with this kid.
How guilty would you feel?
Right? That he was murdered because you were friends with him. Or like, yeah. Because...
They probably thought he was a traitor, like the kid that he, that Iraqi
or were just
kid.
Doing that to fuck with the soldiers, you know?
Absolutely.
Like you make friends with people, we're gonna kill you, and then turn people against you, right? So now no one will talk to you or be friends with you. Zach was eventually discharged from the army. I tried to look up what happened because he did end up getting some medals for like valor and things like that. But despite a commanding officer recommending an honorable discharge, he just received a general one. And it left Zach pretty bitter because the type of discharge is very important in terms of what soldiers are entitled to when they return.
Yeah.
So a general discharge will still give you like the VA benefits and things like that. But because it's not honorable, it excluded him from the GI Bill education benefits. So he couldn't go to school or anything like that. So he didn't really have too many prospects.
I did not know that. I just assumed if you were in the, like, if you were in the military and then like you weren't dishonorably discharged, mm-hmm. that you could get all of the, all those things that were entitled.
Yeah, so apparently it really just sticks to, like, everybody gets the VA benefits again, like, except for, I'm assuming, a dishonorable discharge.
Yeah, dishonorable, they don't.
But I would assume you don't get anything.
No.
But, yeah, so he didn't get any GI Bill education benefits. So a lot of friends around Zach noted that he returned a changed man, and a lot of people suspected him of suffering from PTSD. After he returned in 2005, he separated from Lana and met Addie while working at a bar. So Adrian Addie Hall was described as a free-spirited, feisty, independent woman. They didn't have too much on Addie's background. So as you could tell, I had a lot on Zach's mm-hmm. background. But for Addie, I saw one article that mentioned she was originally from North Carolina, where she faced many hardships growing up. Addie was molested as a child, and this made her weary of men trying to start relationships with her. So even despite this, Addie fell into a series of abusive relationships as she grew up and eventually found herself in New Orleans. Didn't really say why she moved. She just headed out there. So Addie taught dance classes and wrote poetry in addition to working as a bartender in the French Quarter at a bar called the Spotted Cat. And she basically fell in love with all things New Orleans. It's apparently a very popular place to go for that kind of like free sort of lifestyle, like very bohemian type thing. So it attracted her. She described herself as a Puerto Rican or someone who belonged to the French Quarter. But I looked that up because that doesn't sound like what you would call someone from the French Quarter. And nobody calls themselves that. If anything, a Puerto Rican is someone who's a quarter Puerto Rican.
That's what I thought you were talking about when you said it.
I know.
Like,
but
quarter Puerto Rican?
No. As far as I could tell, she was not Puerto Rican. She was a blonde woman. I mean, not saying Puerto Ricans can't be blonde, but she did not look Puerto Rican. So I don't know. She used that term as someone who belonged to the French Quarter, but as far as I know, people there don't call themselves. I don't know. If you're listening to us and you're from the French Quarter, let us know if that is correct or not. But as far as Urban Dictionary is concerned, that is not what that means. So while working together at the Spotted Cat, Zach actively pursued Addie. So Addie kept him at arm's length because remember, she's a little wary of guys. And she kind of saw him as like this ex-military guy, completely opposite to her like free spirit sort of attitude. It was just like when you hear that someone was in the military, you kind of think that they're like very structured and they're used to like a lot of, at least that's what I think.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that's very disciplined, very rigid.
Yes, yes. And not like her at all, but he kept like talking to her, trying to make her laugh. He was very popular at the bar because like I said, he was pretty charming. So he would like do magic tricks for the bar patrons and all the women liked to be around him. It would help him with his tips. So one night Zach stayed at the bar until after Addie's shift ended because she would work the shift after he did. And so the two had some shots and they opened up to each other. They started talking, getting to know each other, and they became really close. Zach's mother, Lori, even recalls him telling her that he had met his soulmate, like the love of his life, that they were just perfect for each other.
Okay.
And even to one of Addie's best friends, who ended up being a mutual friend to both of them because he ended up working with Zach later on, he even said that she kind of went off the grid for a few weeks, and then when he saw her, she seemed happy, they were smiling, they seemed really content with each other. So Hurricane Katrina was coming around, so this was probably about a month or two after their relationship started, the hurricane warnings started coming in. So as evacuations of the city were taking place, Lana, Zach's wife, because they're just separated, they're not divorced, she was asking Zach to come home, be with her and the kids. She's like, I don't have a car. I mean, it's a scary thing to be in a hurricane. And I'm assuming she lives somewhere in Louisiana. It didn't really say, but somewhere outside of where, because I don't think the whole state was put on lockdown. I think it was just part of Louisiana for Katrina. I don't know. It's been so long. So they were somewhere else. And he instead chose to stay with Addie because she wanted to stay and ride out the storm in her apartment. It didn't really say why. I think she was just fearful of the hurricane. Maybe she didn't think they'd make it out in time. I don't know. But she wanted to stay.
Okay.
So he chose to stay with her, which, of course, Lana didn't really understand. She was very upset by it because why would he not want to be with his children during a hurricane? But Zach was living this lifestyle even before he started dating Addie, where he was just back to being a young man, right? Like, he was just living his life.
He didn't even really have that opportunity because he was a dad at 17. So, you know, like, he had to grow up kind of fast, and he joined the military and he did all these responsible things. So probably didn't have that opportunity to be that kind of young, stupid guy who partied and, you know, was kind of just free and doing whatever he wanted.
Yeah. So now he was doing that. So they stayed in her apartment. They rode out the storm and nobody was really able to reach them because pretty much as soon as the hurricane hit, all the power was shut down. So they didn't have a lot of power. So even though they couldn't reach anybody and they were in the apartment, they basically entered their own little paradise. They drank and cooked food for fellow neighbors. Because where they were at near the French Quarter, like, not a lot of that was really super affected. Like, it still got hit with the hurricane, but nowhere near like the immense flooding that we saw in a lot of the other parts of the state. And so they basically hung out. They had little cookouts. They rescued stray kittens that were in the neighborhood. They helped neighbors clean up around the area. They had this, their own little community where everyone was just kind of enjoying the freedom. Like, they didn't have to work. Then no one was worried about bills. Everyone was safe, at least in that moment. And they were just enjoying life. And so for Addie and Zach, they started falling deeper in love. They liked to spend all their time together. And basically, they had no outside worries, right? Zach didn't have to think about his wife and his kids. He didn't have to worry about anything. He could even forget some of the traumas from the war. He was just isolated, right? He was just with her. And in one of the articles I read, it did say that Addie didn't know that he had a wife and kids at first. Oh. And when he told her, which I want to say happened right before Katrina, or if not, at least like somewhere in that mix, that she found out, she was kind of upset about it, but what's done is done, I guess.
Yeah.
So their way of writing out the hurricane gained attention from news publications, and the New York Times even wrote a piece about them and others who decided to ignore evacuations orders. So it was just a brief little paragraph where they interviewed them, and it was basically just that Addie ensured that the police would continue to patrol the area by flashing them as they went by. So So they kept just driving by. And so they had that brief little snippet of her there. But as the hurricane waters receded and New Orleans slowly began to rebuild, the two reached the end of their partying. In terms of that, Lana was pissed because when the New York Times came to interview them, Zach actually called his mom to let him know he was okay, because he was like, obviously we didn't have a phone, and gave them an opportunity to call. So his mom was happy. I don't know what the communication between the mom and Lana was, but it didn't seem to be anything, because Lana said she didn't find out that he was okay, because this whole time she's worried. She hasn't heard from him. He's not answering a phone, nothing.
Yeah.
And so there was a Red Cross website where you could look up people to see if someone was like in a hospital or a shelter, one of the safe spots. And when she looked his name up, the article popped up for the New York Times. And that's how she found out that he was okay and just living his best life, having like looking at the stars and having cookouts and drinking. They were making drinks for people who were passing by. Like they were just
living their best life.
Yeah. So a month after the hurricane ended, Zach finally reached out to Lana. She was upset by his actions, and the two agreed, much to Addie's disapproval, to discuss custody. So they met at a bar. Addie was disapproving of this. It didn't really say exactly why. I think it was more the fact that Lana, like, she was calling the shots, basically. Mm-hmm. So she set up the terms of the custody of, like, the kids are, you're going to have the kids on the weekends and all of this. And so the children started coming around to Addie's apartment. And she grew jealous and angry over the fact that Zach was separated, but not actually divorced.
Justifiable. So I'd be a bit upset by that, too.
Yeah. So reality hit hard as Addie had to go back to work at the Spotted Cat, and Zach ended up getting a job at a grocery store where he worked with Addie's best friend. They call him Cass. His name is a little tricky. Like, it's Capriccio. Capriccio. I've never heard that name before, but I'm going to call him Cass because it's an easier thing to say. So they ended up working together at a grocery store. So now that they're back in the real world, right, bills come into play and it's not this big fun partying environment, and it's not just them two anymore. The outside world also be play. So during their time in the hurricane, they were drinking a lot and had even got into using cocaine occasionally. So they became basically a powder keg fueled by drugs and alcohol. And so they started fighting a lot. Addie was a heavy drinker and she became pretty mean when she was drunk. And Zach had a lot of PTSD. So he had constant mood swings with things where he would just be upset randomly and it would just fuel when they were both upset at the same time. So their fights began to escalate from verbal assaults to physical ones as the two became increasingly jealous of each other. Addie's boss even remembers her coming into work and she saw bruises on her and was like, "What's going on?" And she was like, "Well, he hit me." But still, the two kept coming back and forth to each other. Zach didn't like Addie's behavior as she worked the customers at the bar. So like normal bartenders, I think, do, right? A little bit of flirting, a little bit dancing. And it was her job to kind of bring, and you're in the French Quarter, right? Like you're trying to bring the crowds into your bar. And so that's what she was doing. And so he would get really jealous of her doing that. And she was angered because he started going out all night. He would cheat on her when he was out. And each time they would separate, they would soon find themselves back in each other's arms, missing the other too much. They even say that at one point they fought really bad and he's like, "Forget it, I'm going to Seattle," because he had family over there. So he bought a train ticket and I think was gone maybe a day or two before he headed back because he missed her too much and she missed him. Because her friend
That's a very unhealthy relationship.
Very unhealthy. But you think they both went through trauma and that abandonment and those things. And it's just... And then with drugs and alcohol in the mix, it's not an ideal thing. So they were basically caught in this endless cycle of fighting and making up, and it was all exacerbated by the alcohol and the drugs they were using. So Zach continued to have affairs, and they continued to get in physical fights, so much so that, like I said, Addie's boss, Yura, who thought of Addie as a daughter, even like noticed all of the bruises she was getting. And Yura was also featured in that episode that I watched. And she recalls that Zach said to Addie one time, and I don't know if this is her hearing it from Addie or if it happened at the bar, but he said, "If I can't have you, then no one will." Mm. So it was just this constant cycle back and forth. They were still adjusting, and they decided, Addie got in a dispute with her landlord. So the two decided to get another place together. So they ended up moving into 826 North Rampart Street, and the apartment there was located above the Voodoo Spiritual Temple that was there. And it was just this, mostly like a lot of places, I think it has that where there's a storefront and then there's a apartment on top. So the two were allowed to live there without a lease due to the fact that they were able to pay cash for the first month's rent and a deposit, which was pretty rare after Katrina. Not a lot of people had money. So this landlord was just trying to get people in there. And he was like, "Okay, you can pay cash. Cool, you're done." So they stayed there for a while without a lease until on October 4th, 2006, Addie would demand a 6-month lease from the landlord without Zach's name on it. after finding out that he had an affair with a man because Zach was bisexual. And I only saw this in one place, so I don't know, but it was her friend that said it in the episode. I couldn't find it in any of the articles, but apparently Addie was pretty homophobic. So that was like the ultimate insult to her, was like, it made her look dumb that he had an affair with a man and she didn't like it. It was a whole thing. So she was kicking him out. And that's when Zach called the landlord and he was pissed. And he was like, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, why did you let her sign this lease? Because apparently Zach put down a lot of most of that cash because he was making good money at the grocery store. So the landlord, I guess, went to the apartment. Again, I found this in one article. I didn't find it at all. So normally I'll tell you guys, if I don't find it in more than one article, I'm going to kind of preface it with, I don't know how accurate it is. Okay, but the landlord said he went to the apartment and heard them yelling. And he was basically just like, figure it out. You guys need to work this out, I guess. And then he ended up leaving. And the two started fighting again after he left. So Addie was hurling insults at Zach, and he grew angrier and angrier, just wanting her to shut up. So he finally grabbed her by the neck and calmly strangled her. All right. So what happens next is described in detail by pages that were found in Addie's journal at the scene, and they're written by Zach. So this is, he was writing what happened. So again, you do not want to listen to this. Fast forward a little bit. In fact, I will timestamp in the description of this episode where you should fast forward to not listen to all the graphic details. So I'll give you a second. Okay. All right. If you're still with us, here we go. So Zach stated that after he strangled her, he sexually defiled her body multiple times while contemplating how to dispose of it. Zach was still very drunk, so he then passed out next to her before waking up in time for his shift at the grocery store. He left for work, and like I said, their mutual friend worked at that store, so he even talked to him, and he was like, what's up? You look kind of upset. And he was like, Addie just took some money from me, packed up her stuff, and she went back to North Carolina. And their friend Cass even remembers thinking for a split second that he might have hurt her or did something to her. Yeah. He kind of brushed it off like, no, I know this guy, like, we're friends. There's no way he could do something like that. So later that night, around 9 p.m., Zach returned to the apartment and moved Addie to the bathtub. There, he grabbed a saw and removed her feet, her hands, and her head. He claims to have given her an awful haircut before putting her head in the oven and her hands and feet in some water on the stovetop. Yeah, you're looking at me like this is crazy.
Like, okay, this is just totally not the direction I thought it was going to go, but okay.
Nope, but it gets worse. So he continued to drink alcohol for hours before turning off the stove and filling the tub with water, which the rest of her body is still in that tub.
Yeah.
So 4 days later, because he continued to go to work and do other things. So 4 days later, Zach sawed off the rest of her legs and arms and put them in a roasting pan and placed them in the oven. He then passed out and woke up 7 hours later when he said there was an awful smell coming from the kitchen. So he turned off the oven and went to work. That night, Zach was so overcome by his actions that he drank bottle after bottle of Jameson whiskey and snorted large lines of cocaine. He went out and spent hundreds of dollars at strip clubs, on lap dances and things like that, and then basically fell off the grid for 2 days. Nobody really heard from him. On the third day, Zach invited Capriccio, their mutual friend, out for drinks and lap dances. He said, it's on me. I got you. Let's just go. So he said that Zach was basically back to his old happy self again. He was smiling, laughing. They were having a good time together. And so over the next few days, there were other parties, more drugs, more drinking. And finally, when he was at a housewarming party Cass was throwing, he told him, hey, thanks. I'm going to go on vacation, so I'll see you in a few days. And just took off. On October 17th, a little over 2 weeks after killing Addie, Zach went up to the rooftop bar of the Omni Royal Orleans Hotel and had some more drinks. The bartender was nervous as Zach was pacing the rooftop, thinking that he would skip out on the tab, but Zach wasn't pacing. He was practicing. Suddenly, when he was done, Zach ran toward the side of the building and jumped. Detective Tom Morovic was the responding detective because people were calling saying that a man had landed on a in a parking garage, like at the roof of a parking garage. And so when he arrived, the coroner was there and they were going through Zach's pockets to try to find some form of ID. They came across a small plastic bag in one of his pockets. Inside were Zach's dog tags, as well as a note that read in part, "This is not accidental. I had to take my own life to pay for the one that I took. If you send a patrol to 826 North Rampart, you will find the dismembered corpse of my girlfriend, Addie, in the oven, on the stove, and in the fridge, along with full documentation on the both of us and a full signed confession from myself, Zach Bowen." So that's only part of the letter. I couldn't find anything else or like what else was said in there. It did mention some other parts of him just feeling really guilty.
So he was cooking like her body this entire time or just left on the stove?
So, well, let's wait till the end, because then they're okay. going to talk. We're going to talk about like some rumors surrounding this, but I'll get to that. Either way, you can find her on the stove. So officers rushed to the apartment where they discovered what they described as something out of a horror movie. And that landlord, when he was told that he has to let them into the apartment, was like terrified because he had just left them fighting. So he didn't know what he was walking into. The place was a cold 60 degrees because he had turned the air on to keep everything cold, because like we were talking about, it's very humid and hot in there, and now he has a body. So they found painted messages on the wall when they arrived that read things like, "Look in the oven, total failure, I loved her, call Lana Bowen," and then in parentheses, "wife." And in the bathroom on the wall, because in the TV show I watched, they actually showed crime scene photos so you could see it. So it was all written in just like blotchy little like short sentences of what it said. In the bathroom on the wall above the tub, it said, "I'm sorry I couldn't finish." Also too, I forgot to mention it earlier, but on Zach's body when they found him, he had 28 cigarette burns on him. And they later found out in reading the journal that it was, he burned himself 28 times for every year of his life that he failed. He basically felt like he failed at everything. So Detective Morovic entered the kitchen and found a note painted on the oven saying, "Don't look," which is kind of interesting, which again goes to how the drugs and alcohol are affecting him, because on the wall it says, "Look in the oven," and then
says, "It is no," and everything.
He first opened the pots on the stove and found Addie's head in one and her hands and feet in the other. When he opened the oven, he found her arms and legs and was shocked to find potatoes and carrots chopped up on the counter next to the stove. And the roasting pan appeared to have seasoning on it, as well as on the body parts that were inside.
God.
In the refrigerator, police found a large black garbage bag that held Addie's torso. As police read through the journal Zach wrote, this is one of the entries they found. "I scared myself, not just by the action of calmly strangling the woman I've loved for 1.5 years and then desecrating her body, but my entire lack of remorse. I've known for forever how horrible of a person I am, ask anyone, and decided to quit my jobs and spend the $1,500 in cash I had being happy until I killed myself. So that's what I did. Good food, good drugs, good strippers, good friends, and any loose ends I may have had. I didn't contact any of my family, so that'll explain the shock, and had a fantastic time living out my days. It's just about time now." So this was found in the journal, and it did say, so in there, his mom had no idea what had happened. Lana was told, she got the call from the coroner basically saying that Zach was dead, and she was freaking out because he had actually called her, I believe, the night before and asked her to come out to have like drinks and stuff with him. And she said no. And so she didn't know, like, maybe he was going to confess. Maybe he was trying to say goodbye. She goes, I don't know. So the rumors swirled around as people learned about the case. So some say Zach engaged in cannibalism because obviously things were seasoned and there was food, and why would he cook her? But police luckily found no traces of any human remains in him during the autopsy. The main thing was that they believe that he did that to her to try to dispose of the body in an easier way, because it did describe like parts of her, it was coming off of her. So he thought maybe this would be an easier way to get rid of her, but he just didn't follow through. Others say, another rumor, it says that a demon may have entered him from the voodoo temple below, but that's a huge reach.
I totally was thinking that. I was like, I wonder if somebody brings up the voodoo store. Because, like, yes. What's going on there?
Yeah, but that's a huge reach because, like most things, voodoo isn't portrayed in the media how it actually is. So they find it highly unlikely. And a lot of voodoo is pretty popular in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really seen as like this evil enemy thing, that place is not really a bad place from what I saw. So I don't know. That was a huge reach, but they were saying that a demon entered him and was causing him to drink and do drugs and do all of these things. Of course, but he was doing that well before they moved into this apartment. So the most likely reason that Zach did what he did was PTSD. That, in conjunction with the prolonged abuse of alcohol and drugs, made Zach a ticking time bomb. And so, I mean, I wanted to talk about, so like I said, I was going to bring up why I wanted to include the graphic details. So the reason I wanted to bring up and why I felt it necessary to include the graphic details of the crime is to really show the breakdown of this. And we talked about it before, but it needs to be repeated again, is how important mental health services are, and especially for our veterans and the things that they have endured. I mean, to think that if he had gotten the help and support that he needed from that, then this could have ended totally differently. And even if he had gotten that honorable discharge, which again, I don't know why he didn't. I mean, it said he got accommodations and things like that for his time in the service. So even if he had gotten that and been able to continue an education, people would have been around him to possibly get him into the mental health services that he needed, because this is something that he struggled with. It sounds like he went through some pretty awful things there that really resonated with him. And even with Addie's case, so there was some, so like I said, I couldn't find too much background on her, which I thought was pretty unfortunate. And also apparently there was a book that was written about them, and they did interview the guy, the author of that book, in that Handsome Devils show, and his stuff felt very, it's called Shake the Devil Off was the name of the book. And I didn't really want to read it, and I didn't look too much, because a lot of the comments about the book were saying that it was very one-sided, and it's very much about Zach and his thing, and almost portraying Addie as if it was kind of her fault, or if she in some way brought this. And I think that's totally, it has nothing to do with her, the way she is. I mean, who knows? Maybe if he had stayed home with Lana and the kids, that something might have happened to them. And so I think it's really unfair if we look at it as like, oh, well, Addie was drinking and Addie yelled at him and she couldn't accept what he was doing, or she didn't get him help. But she's also a victim here, in that she went through some very traumatic things. And she also didn't receive the help and care that she needed, because being abused like that and staying in these very possessive and violent relationships, she needed some mental health help with that. And she needed some counseling and some support to move past that. And so you take these two very flawed people and you bring them together, and it becomes this very terrible thing. And it's a tragedy. And that's why I see them both as victims. And obviously Addie is way more of a victim because she got killed. But in the sense, they're both that. They both did not get the help that they needed. And they were both put in these situations that became very chaotic and very out of control. And just going through that and going through, because even though Hurricane Katrina was kind of like a good thing for their relationship, that had to have hit them hard economically, because that area was shut down for a while. They didn't have, they had to make money, they had to pay their bills, they had to get their a place for themselves, like all of these things tacked on to this relationship that was already very chaotic just wasn't a good thing in this situation. So so I just wanted to talk about just the mental health things also too. Don't blame voodoo for this kind of shit, like that's so. But it also too, in one of the articles I read, brought up another interesting point, another reason why I wanted to talk about this case, because after everything that happened, in New Orleans especially, there's a lot of haunted places and haunted tours and things like that. And one of them actually bought the apartment that they lived in, and that's included in one of the tours. And I want to say that there's based somewhere nearby, if not having gotten into the voodoo shop itself and like started that, but basically created this walkthrough thing where people could walk through and look at the actual stove and look at the fridge and look at all these things. And it brought to, and in the article I read, it was bringing up the discussion of people's love of true crime or interest in it.
Yeah.
And that line of like, how far is too far? And so let me just be clear in that while I am very interested in true crime, I'm not about glorifying it. These things are horrible tragedies. And even though there might be some situations in which like me and you laugh about some things or talk about the craziness of some aspects, it is never okay to glorify these types of things because these are not idols to look up to. These are not like sideshow things to make money off of. People died and they suffered. And both of these young people who were, I think they were both 28 at the time, they, to suffer that much at 28 is a terrible thing. And then to exploit it for some haunted tour or whatever is bullshit. And so they faced a lot of flack for that. And luckily, I believe the apartment is still on the tour, but they don't, it's not advertised and it's not it's not like this big sell of like, oh, look at this murder apartment or whatever, which I still think, like, I don't know, if you're making money off of something like that, I think it's still kind of wrong. I don't know if I would necessarily do those types of murder tours. Like, I don't know. And then I don't know where I draw the line into of like, how long ago does a crime have to happen for it to be? Because obviously, like, I've been to like the Winchester House or looking at places where it's like crimes that happened like way, 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 way back in like the day. Haunted houses are somewhat deemed like not as bad for me because it's been like hundreds and hundreds of years, but I don't know. So it did bring up that point, but I think there's definitely a difference between being interested in true crime and wanting to learn about these things and then glorifying it to this whole other level of like, oh, I want to go be in the actual house because I have no desire to see the kitchen that she was murdered.
Oh no, I wouldn't either.
I mean I have no desire to see that. That's not paying homage to her in any way.
No.
Versus learning about these two and the unfortunate things and then doing something about it. I think that the more that we push for those mental health services for these people and the more that we push for reform in a lot of these things, I know we've been talking a lot about police reform and prison reform, mental health reform. Like there's so many things that need to come of this.
More education on domestic violence and inter-partner violence relationships and how to help support if you know that your friends or family member are going through that, like figuring out how to like help them. There's just so many more, things that should be discussed instead of like just walking in and
let's go this, look like, at all of this room. Apartment.
Definitely.
So I thought it was an important story to share. Sorry if I scarred anybody for life with my gruesome details, but I just think it was important. It
definitely
to show.
Was not where I thought that that story was going. And so I was definitely shocked and horrified that that's where that went. We've told some kind of gruesome bloody, but that one's pretty.
This was probably one of the worst ones that I've
done. And it also makes me wonder, because he did it in such a gruesome kind of detached way of like, what did he see when he was over that he was capable? Because I always am like, what makes people capable of doing the things that they do? And if we're talking about all these atrocities and crimes against humanity and that the government did while they were in Iraq, like it just makes me wonder what he possibly could have witnessed over there that made him like be able to do that. Because I just don't think people that aren't traumatized in some way or something's going on could just do that in a cold, calculated manner. So that was where my thoughts were going the entire time. I was like, whoa, what has this guy seen and done?
And even to the fact that he came back so emotionless and so cold and so detached. And even during everything, that he has those seconds where he's like, dude, I scared myself because I don't feel remorseful. Like, I loved this woman, yet I don't feel anything for, like, I feel bad and I'm terrified that I was able to do this. And I think ultimately that's what led to him taking his own life, is that he couldn't live with the fact that he had become this kind of monster that I'm sure he hated and that he didn't want to become. Yeah. And I also think that it was such a good thing in that show that I watched, how I said they interviewed his mom and everything, for his mom to say, that is something that an insane person does. And that is not who he was. Like, I admired that so much, the strength that takes to admit that something was wrong and that they didn't see it. They couldn't help him, because I'm sure that had to have hurt, because it doesn't sound like his mom lived anywhere in New Orleans. So I think she was still possibly in California or Seattle or wherever.
Yeah.
It wasn't clear on that. But the fact that he was hurting and she didn't know, and that and even if she did know, she might not have known what to do or how do you help in that situation. And for her to not do this thing that I think comes up so many times when we have people who become murderers, is the family tries to be like, well, he was just such a good person and that there's no way. And I don't, but for her to be like, no, like he went insane. Like, that's something that insane people do. And I mean, it's unfortunate, because for her, like, that was her little boy, and he somewhere along the line, he was just gone, and that wasn't him anymore. Yeah, but my hope is that the family is doing okay, like that his mom is doing okay. I didn't find anything else on them, on the family, but hopefully Lana and the children are doing okay, and especially the kids, like, to know that something like that happened to your dad, and that's what he did. But yeah, because Lana even remembers getting the phone call from the coroner, like, saying that he was gone, and her friend called her and was like, have you been watching the news at all? And she was like, no. And she was like, then don't turn on the TV, the things that they've been saying and the things that he did, like, just do not. And she's like, well, what did he do? And her friend was like, I'm not going to tell you right now, but you just need to not watch TV. So that's a great friend to be like, do not traumatize yourself with this.
Yeah.
Don't even. And also too, like, the kids are in the home, so don't even have that anywhere near that. But yeah. And then she called the mom, and the mom was like, I cried for 2 years straight. Like, just, I lost my son.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully the family is doing okay. I mean, this is a tragedy any which way you look at it. And again, this is one of those cases where, I mean, we have a bad guy who's also a victim.
Yeah.
In this. And so definitely we want to get the word out. So I want to add into the blog for this episode, we're going to put a link for domestic violence resources. Mm-hmm. So if you or anybody you know is in one of those relationships, the sites will help you. We're going to do both a national one and a local one, because we do have a lot of listeners in our hometown. And also to some resources for people suffering with PTSD, because it is not a bad thing to admit that you need help.
No.
And it's never too late to ask for help. It's never a shameful thing. And I mean, it could save your life. It could save the life of the people around you. Like, it's just, get help if you need it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story.
Now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities.
Yeah. So do you want to start with your city this week?
Sure. Absolutely. So first off, thank you, Shreveport. It is the birthplace of Jared Leto. So you know how I like to tell my, like, crushes. So I'm a huge, huge fan of Jared Leto, just because of My So-Called Life. That came out, that one season came out exactly at my era. So I was Angela Chase's age. So I thought that Jordan Catalano was the hottest thing since sliced bread. And yeah, so thank you, Shreveport, for that. But I am going to tell you that Shreveport is the home of the Chimp Haven. Well, it's right outside of Shreveport, so we're going to count it. And it is a forested sanctuary of about 200 acres, and it hosts more than 300 chimpanzees, many whom were used, sadly, in biomedical research.
Oh.
So these chimps retired from research experiences, and they enjoy the fruits of the wild here. So they love climbing trees, living in large abandoned social groups, like bonded social groups, eating and playing. Chimp Haven was in a documentary featuring Jane Goodall. So it's just this huge forested area for these chimps who probably didn't have a very good life to begin with. Get to live out the rest of their days just having a good time and enjoying a happy environment. So you can always support them. And so I'll put a link because I'm always for like animal sanctuaries that are healthy, not Tiger King animal sanctuaries. But they're enjoying their retirement is what they call it. And I don't aww, necessarily like that because
they didn't work.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that they get to live their lives out, like, in a happier place.
But apparently, who knew this, in 2000, Congress passed the Chimpanzee Health Improvement Maintenance and Protection, so known as CHIMP Act, establishing a federal sanctuary system to provide lifetime care for chimpanzees retired from medical research.
Oh, who knew? Nice.
I had no idea.
I didn't either. That's cool, though.
So 300 chimps live there. So if you want to, well, I'll link it so that in our blog, so that if you want to donate to this great place that is just wanting to promote the best care for chimpanzees, we'll link it. So thank you, Shreveport, for being a home for all these sadly kind of medically abused chimps.
Yeah. All right. So my city was New Orleans. Or how a lot of people call it, Nolens is what they say. It's now just becoming one giant, like, put together word. It's Nolens. I'm not going to say that because I'm not from New Orleans. Nope. But it is widely considered to be one of the United States' most haunted and spooky cities. So we did talk a little bit about voodoo with my case. But it was actually made popular in the 1800s by Marie Laveau, who was given the nickname of the Voodoo Queen because she did a lot of exorcisms and voodoo practices. There's a lot of stuff on her that you can look up. BuzzFeed's Unsolved actually did a thing on her. And her tomb even attracts more visitors each year than Elvis's does in Graceland.
Oh.
Yeah, so in addition to her, there's also, because of the voodoo throughout the city, there's a lot of haunted places. So not just the houses and the hotels, but also a lot of the stores and the bars in the area are considered haunted. In the French Quarter specifically, the Le Loree Mansion is considered one of the most haunted locations. So it's where the La Loree family and their matriarch, Madame Le Loree, committed a lot of crazy, she used to do experiments and torture a lot of slaves. And
yeah,
it's just the house of horror. So if any of you have ever seen American Horror Story, it was season three, The Coven, it delves in that. It takes place in New Orleans, and they feature Madame Le Loree and Marie Laveau are both featured in there, played by Kathy Bates and Angela Bassett. It's probably one of my favorite seasons of that show. It's really badass, but obviously take that with a grain of salt because they do take some liberties with a lot of stuff. Yeah,
definitely some liberties.
But yeah, so that's one of the things that makes it super haunted, in addition to the fact that also vampires are like a huge thing in New Orleans. Anne Rice, who wrote Interview with a Vampire, was born and raised in New Orleans, and it heavily influenced her work. I think a lot of her stories actually are set in New Orleans.
Almost all of them. I've read every single Anne Rice novel.
Yeah, so each Halloween, they actually have an annual vampire masquerade ball in her honor held at the Elms Mansion. And so, yeah, so they have that, the Le Pavilion Hotel, the Bourbon Orleans Hotel, the Daphne Orleans Hotel. All of those things are considered haunted, as well as the Cary Irish Pub, Chartreuse House Cafe, Pat O'Brien's Bar. Even their cemeteries are obviously considered, I think most cemeteries are considered like paranormal places, but
yeah,
the St. Louis Cemetery, number one, St. Rock Cemetery, and Met Cemetery. Cemetery. I am so sorry if I'm mispronouncing a lot of these words. I do not speak French. But yeah, so they have, like we mentioned too in my story, they have tons of haunted tours that you can go through that'll walk you through a lot of these places. And then I'm pretty sure a lot of those paranormal TV shows have even done things in these areas. So it's just a hotbed for paranormal activity there. So definitely adds to the appeal for me. I like ghost type things, so I would definitely want to check out those kinds of things. I don't know if I want to check out the LaLaurie Mansion though, because that sounds awful, but definitely some interesting fact about New Orleans. It's pretty haunted, so
that is definitely one of the reasons why I would want to go to New Orleans too. And then as I mentioned in our Texas episode, I didn't pick New Orleans, but I guess I could say Shreveport has a vampire series that's based off of, like, in Shreveport in that area. Because if you read Charlene Harris, which she did the Sookie Stackhouse books, which is what True Blood is based off of. So that's in the Shreveport area, which I read all but the last book because I didn't like where that series went. So, and I stopped watching True Blood after a couple seasons because they didn't have the characters I liked from the book, but Anne Rice, almost all of her books. So that's one of the reasons I would totally love to. And then there's another vampire series I read, and I can't even think of the name of it right now, but that also takes place in New Orleans. So I'm guessing, yeah, just anybody who writes about vampires is like Louisiana.
I read two vampire series, like young adult type stuff. So I read Twilight back when that was a thing. And that was in Washington. And then I read another series that did like a bunch of books. They were called the Morganville Vampire Series. They actually were bad. I mean, they're definitely young adult, but they take place in Texas, which is an interesting thing because vampires and the desert or the sun. And definitely it's an ideal, but it was pretty good. Yeah, I actually haven't read any Anne Rice books or anything about New Orleans.
Because they have hers, but then she also has like the Witching Hour books, which are witches. And that takes place in New Orleans as well. So
I'll have to check it out. So if you like reading about vampires, check out Anne Rice.
Yeah, Anne Rice is amazing. But there's one other reason why I want to go to New Orleans. And that is because I love the Food Network. And it's probably the number one reason why I want to go. And my number one, like, so I watch pretty much every show on the Food Network. But so I love Chopped. And one of their judges, Aaron Sanchez.
He's on MasterChef too. Okay, I love him.
So Aaron Sanchez is one of his main restaurants is in New Orleans.
Nice. I would totally want to check that out. He was
I'm like, yes, please. And that was like the number one reason why Jose and I wanted to go there was like that was the one thing on our to-do list was to go to his restaurant. And I'm like, then I would be happy.
There you go. Lots of stuff to do in New Orleans. Yeah. So I had this state fact this week. So with Louisiana, they, because of the state's low elevation, the dead are often laid to rest above ground instead of being buried like most places. Because again, like we said, they get a lot of hurricanes and you don't want people floating up or getting swept away into the ocean. So they have a lot of mausoleums that replace the crypts and markers and cemeteries in New Orleans and other cities. So just a lot of that, which is why, so if you've ever seen The Princess and the Frog, a pretty important scene takes place there. And you can see in the mausoleum and the bad guy even gets trapped in one of the, what is it? Like the wall of the mausoleum, like little, almost like a headstone type thing. So that's pretty interesting. I never really thought about that. I don't want to think about it too much because I don't like to think that they buried people and then hurricanes came and then people floated up because that would make me really sad. But so in New Orleans, Louisiana, they have a lot more mausoleums than in their cemeteries than anything else. Yeah.
They don't bury their dead.
Yeah.
Which makes it totally makes sense when you really think about it. So, so much of Louisiana is kind of swampy and below sea level. And what do you do then? So, then you have to do something. which I bet has a lot of interest, because then it's like a lot of interesting buildings and just design and everything, which I'm sure would be very interesting and fun to kind of go wander and like look at the history, because I love history. So kind of seeing history through that would be kind of interesting.
Because that was a very doom and gloom type of fact talking about death for Louisiana. They also have like almost like more alligators than any other place in the United States. So there's like half as many alligators as there are people in Louisiana.
So for like every two people, there's one alligator?
I think so. That's terrifying.
That is so terrifying to me. And one thing I would never, ever do if I was in Louisiana would be doing one of those swamp tour boat thingies.
Oh,
that
God,
is my literal ideal, like idea of hell. Like I hate snakes. I hate mosquitoes. I hate humidity. I don't like I don't like any kind of reptile, really. I'm not really into amphibians either. So that zero call to go out on one of those boats with the big fan thing.
Yeah.
And spend my, oh, and I also, my skin does not like the sun. That's probably why I like vampires so much. I can totally identify with them.
Nice.
The second I'm out in the sun. Selena can attest to this. The second I'm out in the sun, I turn bright red.
Yeah.
Like 2 minutes.
There's like no tan there. It's just red. That's funny. But yeah, so alligator is terrifying. But do you know how to tell the difference between an alligator and a crocodile?
No.
Yeah, you can tell the difference because some you'll see in a while and some you'll see later.
<You're so stupid>.
It took you a second. You're like, what? Yeah. See you later, alligator.
In a while, crocodile. I thought maybe you really knew it was a fact. You know.
I really do. It's actually, it has to do with the
one freshwater and one saltwater. I don't know. That probably isn't true, Amber. No.
It's their snout shape. So alligators have a wider U-shaped snout and crocodiles have the little pointy V-shaped snout. So so crocodiles do tend to live in saltwater habitats while alligators hang out in freshwater marshes and lakes. But it's really the snout, so if it's coming action.
Honestly, I wouldn't care either way. I'd be scared.
Nope, it's still going to kill you, so
just get the fuck away from it. So no thank you.
Speaking of alligators, crocodiles, I don't remember which one. Did you ever see the horror movie? It came out like a year or two ago. It's called Crawl.
No.
I think you could check it out on Hulu right now, but it's about this, I think it takes place in New Orleans, and there's like a hurricane coming, and so this chick goes, she's trying to get out, but then her dad's not answering the phone, and he was like renovating their old family house because they're selling it because their parents got divorced. And so she bypasses the evacuation stuff and like goes to see where he's at, and it turns out he got trapped. He was like remodeling, something fell on him or whatever. I don't remember the whole thing, but either way, it's about them trying to escape alligator, crocodile, I don't know.
Whatever.
I didn't look at, I don't remember. I
you didn't saw look at the snout? Ago.
I didn't look at the snout, but I don't know. You saw it after a while, so maybe it is a crocodile. But yeah, so this whole movie is about them, like, because then the house obviously starts, like, flooding, like, they're, like, underneath and stuff, and so she's trying to escape these alligators, crocodiles, and it's funny because in one scene, like, it's like filling up the house like with water, and she is in the bathroom and she has one of those slider showers.
Yeah.
And so she's in the bathtub and the door's closed, and like obviously the water is like kind of starting to rise a little bit, and it comes in the room. It's like slinking and all scary looking and shit. So her plan, and it's the stupidest plan, it would not work, and do not do this, but she opens the shower, so it starts coming in the shower, and then she jumps over the top of the shower, locking it in the fucking shower, and then goes, and I'm like, bitch, do you think you could move faster than an alligator or a crocodile? Like, that thing would have you in its mouth before you even launched your ass over the thing. But it works for her, of course. It was the funniest fucking thing. And it wasn't a terrible movie. Like, as far as, like, I've seen some pretty fucking terrible, like, I love cheesy horror movies. I like laughing at them because I think they're ridiculous. But it wasn't that bad. It was just some situations where you're like, really? Like, this thing is so much faster than you in water. Like, on land, okay, you might have a shot because they move that fast, but not that quick. But in water, you're not swimming fast. Mm-mm. If I'm in the water with an alligator, it's just gonna fucking eat me. Like, I don't know, I might try to punch it in the face like a shark, but I don't know if that works for those. I don't know, maybe that just means punch it eats my arm first. I don't know, like, stab it in the eye. I don't fuck, but the snout is so long, how are you gonna get to the eye? I don't know, I don't fuck know. If I am ever unfortunately in a swamp and one of those creatures comes at me, my ass is done.
That's why, yet again, I'm not going on one of those swamp tours. Like, fuck no. What if the boat turns? There's just no. What if it somehow gets into the boat? What the hell are you going to do? No. Better not put yourself, just don't put yourself in those situations. And then nothing can happen.
Exactly.
I was just watching on Facebook the other day. And there was, like, I don't know, crocodile, alligator. I don't know what it was. But just, like, walking around on the land in a parking lot. And I'm, like, if I saw that, I would, like, what the See, I am not in a lane. I am not standing
filming it.
Yeah, people are just, like, filming it. And, like, oh, look at, no. Get out of here. There's no way. Really, just leave them alone. Anything wild animal, just leave alone.
Let it do its thing.
Just let it do its thing. Watch it, name them, whatever. Just don't befriend them.
Yeah, don't touch them. Yeah, so thank you guys for listening. And we hope you enjoyed the Louisiana episode. Again, I hope I didn't scar you too much. You know your limits, not me. Yep. So I warned you twice. But yeah, so if you like what you hear, like and follow us on Facebook and on Instagram. Also, too, it would really help us out. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes or leave us a review on Facebook. It lets people know how to find us. And the more reviews we get, the more we pop up on other people's, like, what to listen to type lists and things like that. So please do that for us. We'd really appreciate it. And yeah, so don't forget to check out stateofmurder.com for all the bonus content, the links that we mentioned in this episode and every episode. We always have links and pictures and fun things for you guys there at the blog. So check it out. And next week, we are going to be in
Arkansas
or Arkansas is what it looks like to me. So
And in Kansas there's the Arkansas River, but they call it the Arkansas River until it hits the Arkansas border, and then it's the Arkansas River.
States are weird. What the fuck, Kansas?
Fun fact.
Kansas is like, no, you're our name, and then Arkansas is like, no, we're our own name.
Yep. So
we'll also, how do you look at, we'll talk about it when we get to Arkansas, but how do you look at the way Arkansas is spelled and say Arkansas?
I don't know.
I mean, I might actually be on Kansas's side about that. So you know what the hell,
Arkansas? What the hell, Arkansas? You should be called Arkansas.
Arkansas.
So next week we're going to be in Arkansas.
So we'll see you guys next week. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thank you. Bye.